Chapter 3. Eyes from the girl's face to that of her partner, which, in the exhilaration of the dance, had taken on a look of almost impudent ownership. Dennis Eady was the son of Michael Eady, the ambitious Irish grocer, whose suppleness and effrontery had given Starkfield its first notion of smart business methods, and whose new brick store testified to the success of the attempt. His son seemed likely to follow in his steps, and was meanwhile applying the same arts to the conquest of the Starkfield maidenhood. Hitherto Ethan Frome had been content to think him a mean fellow, but now he positively invited a horse whipping. It was strange that the girl did not seem aware of it. That she could lift her rapt face to her dancer's, and drop her hands into his, without appearing to feel the offense of his look and touch. Frome was in the habit of walking into Starkfield to fetch home his wife's cousin, Maddie Silver, on the rare evenings when some chance of amusement drew her to the village. It was his wife who had suggested, when the girl came to live with them, that such opportunities should be put in her way. Maddie Silver came from Stamford, and when she entered the Frome's household to act as her cousin Zena's aide, it was thought best, as she came without pay, not to let her feel too sharp a contrast between the life as he had left and the isolation of a Starkfield farm. But for this, as Frome sardonically reflected, it would hardly have occurred to Zena to take any thought for the girl's amusement. When his wife first proposed that they should give Maddie an occasional evening out, he had inwardly demurred at having to do the extra 2 miles to the village and back after his hard day on the farm, but not long afterward he had reached the point of wishing that Starkfield might give all its nights to revelry. Maddie Silver had lived under his roof for a year, and from early morning till they met at supper he had frequent chances of seeing her. But no moments in her company were comparable to those when, her arm in his, and her light step flying, to keep time with his long stride, they walked back through the night to the farm. He had taken to the girl from the first day, when he had driven over to the flats to meet her, and as he had smiled and waved to him from the train, crying out, "You must be Ethan." As she jumped down with her bundles, while he reflected, looking over her slight person, " she don't look much on housework, but she ain't a fretter, anyhow." But it was not only that the coming to his house of a bit of hopeful young life was like the lighting of a fire on a cold hearth. The girl was more than the bright serviceable creature he had thought her. As he had an eye to see, and an ear to hear. He could show her things, and tell her things, and taste the bliss of feeling that all he imparted left long reverberations and echoes he could wake at will. It was during their night walks back to the farm that he felt most intensely the sweetness of this communion. He had always been more sensitive than the people about him to the appeal of natural beauty. His unfinished studies had given form to this sensibility, and even in his unhappiest moments field and sky spoke to him with a deep and powerful persuasion. But hitherto the emotion had remained in him as a silent ache, veiling with sadness the beauty that evoked it. He did not even know whether anyone else in the world felt as he did, or whether he was the sole victim of this mournful privilege. Then he learned that one other spirit had trembled with the same touch of wonder. That at his side, living under his roof and eating his bread, was a creature to whom he could say, "That Sir Ian down yonder, the big fellow to the right is Aldebaran, and the bunch of little ones like bees swarming there the Pleiades." Daughter whom he could hold entranced before a ledge of granite thrusting up through the fern, while he unrolled the huge panorama of the Ice Age, and the long dim stretches of succeeding time. The fact that admiration for his learning mingled with Maddie's wonder at what he taught, was not the least part of his pleasure. And there were other sensations, less definable but more exquisite, which drew them together with a shock of silent joy. The cold red of sunset behind winter hills, the flight of cloud flocks over slopes of golden stubble, or the intensely blue shadows of hemlocks on sunlit snow. When she said to him once, "It looks Just as if it was painted, it seemed to Ethan that the art of definition could go no farther, and that words had at last been found to utter his secret soul. As he stood in the darkness outside the church, these memories came back with the poignancy of vanished things. Watching Maddie whirl down the floor from hand to hand, he wondered how he could ever have thought that his dull talk interested her. To him, who was never gay, but in her presence, her gaiety seemed plain proof of indifference. The face she lifted to her dancers was the same which, when she saw him, always looked like a window that has caught the sunset. He even noticed two or three gestures which, in his fatuity, he had thought she kept for him. A way of throwing her head back when she was amused, as if to taste her laugh before she let it out, and a trick of sinking her lids slowly when anything charmed or moved her. The sight made him unhappy, and his unhappiness roused his latent fears. His wife had never shown any jealousy of Maddie, but of late as he had grumbled increasingly over the housework, and found oblique ways of attracting attention to the girl's inefficiency. Zena had always been what Starkfield called ickly, and Frome had to admit that, if she were as ailing as she believed, she needed the help of a stronger arm than the one which lay so lightly in his during the night walks to the farm. Maddie had no natural turn for housekeeping, and her training had done nothing to remedy the defect. She was quick to learn, but forgetful and dreamy, and not disposed to take the matter seriously. Ethan had an idea that if she were to marry a man she was fond of, the dormant instinct would wake, and her pies and biscuits become the pride of the county, but domesticity in the abstract did not interest her. At first she was so awkward that he could not help laughing at her, but she laughed with him, and that made them better friends. He did his best to supplement her unskilled efforts, getting up earlier than usual to light the kitchen fire, carrying in the wood overnight, and neglecting the mill for the farm, that he might help her about the house during the day. He even crept down on Saturday nights to scrub the kitchen floor after the women had gone to bed. And Zena, one day, had surprised him at the churn, and had turned away silently, with one of her queer looks. Of late there had been other signs of her disfavor, as intangible but more disquieting. One cold winter morning, as he dressed in the dark, his candle flickering in the draft of the ill-fitting window, he had heard her speak from the bed behind him. "The doctor don't want I should be left without anybody to do for me," she said in her flat whine. He had supposed her to be asleep, and the sound of her voice had startled him, though she was given to abrupt explosions of speech after long intervals of secretive silence. He turned and looked at her, where she lay indistinctly outlined under the dark calico quilt, her high-boned face taking a grayish tinge from the whiteness of the pillow. "Nobody to do for you," he repeated. "If you say you can't afford a hired girl when Maddie goes." Frome turned away again, and taking up his razor stooped to catch the reflection of his stretched cheek in the blotched-looking glass above the washstand. "Why on earth should Maddie go?" "Well, when she gets married, I mean," his wife's drawl came from behind him. "Oh, she'd never leave us, as long as you needed her," he returned, scraping hard at his chin. "I wouldn't ever have it said that I stood in the way of a poor girl like Maddie marrying a smart fellow like Dennis Eady," Zena answered in a tone of plaintive self-effacement. Ethan, glaring at his face in the glass, threw his head back to draw the razor from ear to chin. His hand was steady, but the attitude was an excuse for not making an immediate reply. "And the doctor don't want I should be left without anybody," Zena continued. "He wanted I should speak to you about a girl he's heard about, that might come." Ethan laid down the razor, and straightened himself with a laugh. "Dennis Eady. If that's all, I guess there's no such hurry to look round for a girl." "Well, I'd like to talk to you about it," said Zena obstinately. He was getting into his clothes in fumbling haste. "All right. But I haven't got the time now. I'm late as it is," he returned, holding his old silver turnip watch to the candle. Xena, apparently accepting this as final, lay watching him in silence, while he pulled his suspenders over his shoulders, and jerked his arms into his coat. But as he went toward the door, she said, suddenly and incisively, colon, I guess you're always late. Now you shave every morning. That thrust had frightened him more than any vague insinuations about Denisidi. It was a fact that since Maddie Silver's coming he had taken to shaving every day, but his wife always seemed to be asleep when he left her side in the winter darkness, and he had stupidly assumed that she would not notice any change in his appearance. Once or twice in the past he had been faintly disquieted by Zenobia's way of letting things happen without seeming to remark them, and then, weeks afterward, in a casual phrase, revealing that as he had all along taken her notes and drawn her inferences. Of late, however, there had been no room in his thoughts for such vague apprehensions. Xena herself, from an oppressive reality, had faded into an insubstantial shade. All his life was lived in the sight and sound of Maddie Silver, and he could no longer conceive of its being otherwise. But now, as he stood outside the church, and saw Maddie spinning down the floor with Denisidi, a throng of disregarded hints and menaces wove their cloud about his brain. 2. As the dancers poured out of the hall from, drawing back behind the projecting storm door, watched the segregation of the grotesquely muffled groups, in which a moving lantern ray now and then lit up a face flushed with food and dancing. The villagers, being afoot, were the first to climb the slope to the main street, while the country neighbors packed themselves more slowly into the sleighs under the shed. Ain't you riding, Maddie? A woman's voice called back from the throng about the shed, and Ethan's heart gave a jump. From where he stood he could not see the persons coming out of the hall till they had advanced a few steps beyond the wooden sides of the storm door, but through its cracks he heard a clear voice answer, colon, mercy, no. Not on such a night. She was there, then, close to him, only a thin board between. In another moment she would step forth into the night, and his eyes, accustomed to the obscurity, would discern her as clearly as though she stood in daylight. A wave of shyness pulled him back into the dark angle of the wall, and he stood there in silence instead of making his presence known to her. It had been one of the wonders of their intercourse, that from the first, she, the quicker, finer, more expressive, instead of crushing him by the contrast, had given him something of her own ease and freedom, but now he felt as heavy and loutish as in his student days, when he had tried to ollie the Worcester girls at a picnic. He hung back, and she came out alone, and paused within a few yards of him. She was almost the last to leave the hall, and she stood looking uncertainly about her, as if wondering why he did not show himself. Then a man's figure approached, coming so close to her that under their formless wrappings they seemed merged in one dim outline. Gentleman friend gone back on you? Say, Matt, that's tough. No, I wouldn't be mean enough to tell the other girls. I ain't as low down as that. How Frome hated his cheap banter. But look a here, ain't it lucky I got the old man's cutter down there waiting for us? Frome heard the girl's voice, gaily incredulous, colon, what on earth's your father's cutter doing down there? Why, waiting for me to take a ride. I got their own colt too. I kinder knew I'd want to take a ride tonight. Edie, in his triumph, tried to put a sentimental note into his bragging voice. The girl seemed to waver, and Frome saw her twirl the end of her scarf irresolutely about her fingers. Not for the world would he have made a sign to her, though it seemed to him that his life hung on her next gesture. Hold on a minute, while I unhitch the colt, Dennis called to her, springing toward the shed. She stood perfectly still, looking after him, in an attitude of tranquil expectancy torturing to the hidden watcher. Frome noticed that she no longer turned her head from side to side, as though peering through the night for another figure. She let Denisidi let out the horse, climb into the cutter and fling back the bearskin, to make room for her at his side. Then, with a swift motion of flight, she turned about and darted up the slope toward the front of the church. Goodbye. hope you'll have a lovely ride. She called back to him over her shoulder. Dennis laughed and gave the horse a cut that brought him quickly abreast of her retreating figure. Come along. Get in quick. It's as slippery as thunder on this turn, he cried, leaning over to reach out a hand to her. She laughed back at him, colon good night. I'm not getting in. By this time they had passed beyond Frome's earshot, and he could only follow the shadowy pantomime of their silhouettes as they continued to move along the crest of the slope above him. He saw Edie, after a moment, jump from the cutter and go toward the girl with the reins over one arm. The other he tried to slip through hers, but she eluded him nimbly, and Frome's heart, which had swung out over a black void, trembled back to safety. A moment later he heard the jingle of departing sleigh bells, and discerned a figure advancing alone toward the empty expanse of snow before the church. In the black shade of the Varnum spruces he caught up with her, and she turned with a quick H. Think I'd forgotten you, Matt, he asked with sheepish glee. She answered seriously, colon I thought maybe you couldn't come back for me. Couldn't? What on earth could stop me? I knew Zena wasn't feeling any too good today. Oh, she's in bed long ago. He paused, a question struggling in him. Then you meant to walk home all alone? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.